Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
He ran, his lungs burning with exertion, his legs aching with the effort, sandals slapping against the flat ground of the plain. He had dropped his wooden shield some time before, along with his helmet, to aid in his flight. His spear was still clutched in one sweaty hand, its sharp bronze point a reassuring sight that did a little to quell his fear and push the bile back down his throat. Just a bit further, he thought. The river was just ahead. He could jump in and swim to the other side, and his pursuers wouldn't be able to catch him. If he made it to the river, he would be safe. Where was it? Where was it? He saw the shallow rise a bowshot ahead of him. Up, then down, and then the river. Nearly there. Without looking back, he knew that some of his fellow soldiers were still with him. He could hear their feet pounding on the dusty, churned earth behind him, along with their labored breathing. His senses were heightened by the fear and adrenaline coursing through his system. Enough that the bronze arrowhead cracking off a rock an arm's length away from him registered clearly. So did the dull thud of another arrow into the flesh of one of his running companions behind him, and the man's howls of pain. Over the din of the cries, the man could hear the clacking of the chariot's spoked wheels, then the horses neighing and the bits jingling in their mouths, then the twang of the bowstring as the archer loosed arrow after arrow at the fleeing men. Still half a bow shot away from the rise, the man chanced to look backwards. He saw the chariot bouncing toward him, the bared teeth of the horses, the curled beards of the vehicle's driver and archer. It was too close, and the distance between them was closing with incredible speed. He would never make it to the river in time. In the distance, he could see half a dozen other chariots swirling across the plain, picking off his erstwhile companions one by one as if for sport. Which, the man supposed in a brief moment of clarity, this actually was. It was sport for these charioteers in the service of the king of the Hurrian soldiers. Just his bad luck. The man stopped running and faced the chariot, glimpsing the archer's smile as he pulled back his bowstring one more time and saw the glint of sunlight on the bronze arrowhead. It was the last thing he saw. In the years around 1500, a whole series of new states rose in the Near East. Unlike their predecessors, which had built on the ancient traditions of the millennia-old cities of the region, these were territorial states fielding armies full of chariots, ruled by warrior kings who fought and competed with one another on a grand scale. Hittites, Kassites, Mitanni, Egyptians, Assyrians. These were the players in the political world of the late Bronze Age, an era unlike any that had come before. And also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our Seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge is out now, and you can order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. If you've ever been looking for a way to support Tides of History, ordering The Verge is the best way you could do it, and I'd really appreciate it. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The late Bronze Age of the Near East and the Aegean was a fascinating and dynamic time. It was a world of cities, kingdoms, writing, diplomacy, and long-distance commerce. The political connections between ruling families and trade in tin, textiles, and luxury goods, along with the exchange of ideas and values, bound that world together from the Iranian plateau to Nubia to Greece. This was an age of famous and heroic kings, sophisticated archives, massive battles involving thousands of chariots. If we conceive of societies as rising, peaking, and then falling, at least from the perspective of literacy, administration, monumental building, if not human welfare per se, well, then the later Bronze Age was an incredible peak. But that interconnected world fell apart around 1200 BC, torn asunder by some combination of climatic change, migrations, warfare, social unrest, and political disintegration. The Bronze Age collapse will be the eventual endpoint of this season of Tides of History, and it's coming sooner rather than later. A few more months will bring us to the destruction of the Mycenaean palaces, the fall of Egypt's new kingdom, and the Mediterranean marauding of the enigmatic Sea Peoples. We'll also do a little more globe-trotting prior to that stretch. We'll catch up with the Olmecs in Mesoamerica, the under-discussed but essential happenings in West Africa, and the emergence of China's first historical dynasty, the Shang. Then, for at least three or four episodes, we'll talk about how that late Bronze Age world fell to pieces. Before we get there, though, we need to understand how that late Bronze Age world came into being in the first place. It hadn't actually existed for very long, just a few centuries. The states that interacted in so many ways, from trading to marrying to fighting, weren't all that old. Neither was the system that incentivized their creation or which sustained them. In fact, all of that was the product of a specific and contingent set of historical circumstances that mostly came into being between around 1600 and 1500 BC. Sure, some of the players had pasts that stretched back much further, Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, and so on, but the particular configurations that defined the Late Bronze Age were all creations of the relatively recent past. Today, we'll explore those various players, focusing on the Hittites of Anatolia, the Mitanni of Syria, the Kassite rulers of Babylon, and a brief nod toward the Middle Assyrian Empire. We'll talk about where these states came from, how they became larger and more powerful than the states that preceded them, and how they interacted with one another in a new and dynamic world. When we left off last time, around the year 1595 BC, Hammurabi of Babylon's last descendant, Samsudittana, was presiding over the end of his dynasty. A new enemy had marched hundreds of miles to Mesopotamia, passing through Syria and along the Euphrates River from an ultimate origin all the way in central Anatolia. Babylon itself fell to these newcomers, who sacked the city before returning home. These were the Hittites, under the rule of a man named Murshili, and never before had they come this far. For the next four centuries, with brief interruptions and setbacks, they would control one of the great powers of the Near East. Within the broader world of Near Eastern politics, as shocking a thrust as their long-distance campaign to Babylon may have been, the Hittites weren't exactly newcomers. Murshili's grandfather, Hattusili, had crossed the Euphrates River into the westernmost fringe of Mesopotamia two generations prior and subdued much of Syria. Before that, powerful kings had ruled in central Anatolia for centuries. The Assyrian merchants of Kanesh, trading textiles and tin for gold and silver, had done business in a city called Hattusha. This was the city from which the Hittite kings ruled. It's not like the Hittites showed up and sacked Babylon out of nowhere. Instead, the growing ascendancy of what we call the Hittite Old Kingdom around 1600 BC was the product of a long, convoluted, and confusing series of events. That series of events took place mostly in Anatolia, in ways we can track, but it also had a much more distant and enigmatic history stretching all the way back to the Eurasian steppes north of the Black Sea. The Hittites had come to power in the city of Hattusha sometime in the 17th century BC, probably in the first half. Hattusha was already old by that time, and so was the land around it. It had been known as the Land of Hatti, which is technically what the Hittites said they ruled, the Land of Hatti, for a very long time, going back at least to the days of Sargon of Akkad 6 centuries before. The Hattic language was entirely different than that of the Hittites, and the cultural traditions of the Hatti people likewise seemed to have differed. The Hittites were actually speakers of an Indo-European language, and a great many scholars have argued for deep Indo-European traditions in everything from their religion to their ideas about kingship. Central Anatolia, the region where we first see the Hittites living, must have been something of an ethnic patchwork, with multiple linguistic and cultural groups living around, with, and sometimes in opposition to one another. So there are a couple of different explanations for this. Hittite isn't the only Indo-European language we see in Anatolia at this time. It was one of several related languages comprising a distinct Anatolian branch of the family that actually survived until after the conquests of Alexander the Great. The Anatolian branch seems to be the group of Indo-European languages that are most deeply diverged from the other Indo-European tongues. This means that their common ancestor separated first, at the deepest point in the past, and therefore it retains archaic characteristics that show up in none of the other branches. As a result of this, one school of thought sees the entire Indo-European language family as being native to Anatolia. The other branches left, according to this interpretation, while Anatolians stayed behind. As we've talked about in the past, I think this is less convincing than the steppe hypothesis, which argues that the language ancestral to later Indo-European branches came into being in the grasslands between the Black and Caspian Seas. This is supported much more strongly by linguistic, archaeological, and especially genetic evidence. But if Proto-Indo-European was actually spoken on the Black Sea steppes around and after 4000 BC, how did one branch of its speakers wind up in Anatolia? That's the conundrum. We simply don't know. What looks like the most likely explanation right now involves a migration from the steppe into what's now Bulgaria and the Balkans, maybe as early as 4000 BC, but only much later from the Balkans to Anatolia, maybe around 2300 BC. Maybe these newcomers were responsible for one of the layers of destruction at the city of Troy on the Aegean coast around that time. We know that Luwian, an Anatolian language related to Hittite, was spoken in Troy's later incarnation. To the east, in the land of Hatti, we know there were speakers of Hittite and Luwian present no later than 2000 BC, because Indo-European names show up in the texts of the Assyrian merchants of Kanesh. But how did these Hittite speakers become a ruling dynasty? And how did they build a kingdom stretching from central Anatolia to the fringes of Mesopotamia? Just a note here, for most of this section, I'm drawing on the wonderful Hittitologist Trevor Bryce's book, The Kingdom of the Hittites, which is still the standard one on this topic. So there were already kingdoms, and powerful ones, in central Anatolia before we hear of any Hittite king. As I mentioned, the region was exceptionally ethnically diverse. There were speakers of Hittite, of course, including at Kanesh, but there were also speakers of the non-Indo-European Hattic and also Hurrian, which we'll talk more about a little later. Lots of people were probably bilingual or multilingual, and we don't have to see this region as one of primordial ethnic conflict. The Hittites never actually called themselves by that name. They were people of the land of Hatti, and their language, what we call Hittite, they referred to as Nessite. Most of the people living in their kingdom probably didn't even speak that language. If they did, it was mostly as a medium of official communication or trade, the language of the king and his administration rather than a marker of a particularly widespread ethnic group. In fact, what was really Hittite about this kingdom, in the sense of language, culture, and practices, was the fact that it drew its ruler from a small and tightly connected group of high-ranking noble families. These families happened to be speakers of an Indo-European Anatolian language. They lent that language their prestige, which made it the common tongue of a multi-ethnic kingdom. The actual inhabitants of that kingdom, to the extent that they had a common identity, found it in the land of Hatti itself and their connection to its ruler, not in ethnicity or language. What we're really talking about here is the emergence of a ruling dynasty, or rather a series of ruling dynasties that eventually built its capital at Hattusha. This was a fractious and violent age of conflict between cities, kingdoms, and their rulers. Prior to becoming the Hittite capital, the old city of Hattusha had actually been destroyed a generation prior by a talented conqueror named Anita. Anita set up an inscription on the site that declared it a cursed spot. "On its site I sowed weeds. May the storm god strike down anyone who becomes king after me and resettles Hattusha." Anita, following in the footsteps of his father Pithana, built a large state that covered much of central Anatolia. The Hittites actually emerged in the aftermath of their wars of conquest, a straightforward consequence of an era of upheaval created by prior generations of conquerors. This era saw the end of the Assyrian trading colonies at Kanesh and elsewhere with their sophisticated practices of long-distance commerce. Our information is limited. We know almost nothing about the decades between Anita's death and the first Hittite king, but it's hard not to see this as an age of disintegration and conflict between petty kingdoms. The Hittites grew out of this chaotic environment. The first Hittite king about whom we can say much was a man named Hattusili I. He wasn't the first Hittite king, per se. His grandfather, Labarna, had apparently built a conquest state before his own sons rebelled against him, leading Hattusili to inherit a smaller chunk. Hattusili was the one who made Hattusha his capital. He picked this highly defensible spot on a rocky outcropping from which to rule. He presumably did so in defiance of Anita's curse, which was an obvious statement of intent for a would-be conqueror. And Hattusili's ambitions proved to be extensive. In just the second year of his reign, he marched more than 300 miles, 500 kilometers, all the way south into Syria, There, Hattusili made war on the powerful kingdom of Yamhad, based at what's now the city of Aleppo in Syria. The results were mixed, including the sack of the major city of Alalakh and the failed siege of another, but Hattusili was able to return home without suffering an outright defeat. The next year, he marched in the opposite direction. He headed somewhere in west or southwest Anatolia, a place called Arzawa, in what was probably more of a raid than a campaign of conquest. After suppressing a few rebellions in his territories, he returned to Syria and then went even further to the westernmost fringes of Mesopotamia. Back at home, however, things were unsettled. Like his grandfather Labarna, Hattusili's sons rebelled against him, and his daughter conspired with the Hittite nobility to oppose Hattusili and place one of her sons on the throne. Hattusili stripped his daughter of her possessions and exiled her, crushed his sons, and named a nephew as his heir. At the last minute before his death, Hattusili instead chose his grandson, a guy named Murshili, to succeed him. Hattusili's reign set the template for his successors, defined the geographic scope of Hittite interests from the Aegean side of Anatolia all the way to Mesopotamia. It set the very bloody terms under which the succession to the kingship would inevitably take place. And most important, it included a mixture of external invasion and raiding with serious internal conflicts. In essence, the king of the land of Hatti was always at war, but that was precisely what the king was supposed to do. War was its own reward, an end in itself. The key wasn't so much permanent conquest as being seen conquering. The image Hattusili chose to describe his campaign in Mesopotamia, one which became a standard part of Hittite kingship, was that of a lion pouncing on its prey and mercilessly destroying it. The counterpart to that was mercy, the king deigning to allow his potential victims to survive. They were opposite sides of the same coin. In all of this, Hattusili and his successors were considered to be representatives of the gods. In one text, we read that when the king bowed to the gods, the priest was to recite the following. May the Tabarna, the king, be dear to the gods. The land belongs to the storm god alone. Heaven, earth, and the people belong to the storm god alone. He has made the Labarna, the king, his administrator and given him the entire land of Hatti. The king followed, to me, the king, the sun god and the storm god have entrusted my country and my house, and I, the king, will protect my country and my house. It's easy for us to look back and see the conflicts between rival potential claimants to the Hittite throne as mere power politics, but we have to imagine a rather more divine aspect to the whole thing. The will of the gods was at stake. Murshili followed Hattusili on the throne and followed his grandfather's example. Hattusili had campaigned in Syria, but Murshili conquered it. Hattusili ventured beyond the Euphrates, but Murshili sacked Babylon, ending Hammurabi's dynasty once and for all. The Hittites were now the major power in eastern Anatolia and much of Syria, but they weren't the only ones. In Babylon, a new dynasty, members of a group called the Kassites, returned the city to something approaching its peak. And in Syria, a whole new kingdom, the Mitanni, established themselves as a force to be reckoned with.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The Hittite sack of Babylon marked the beginning of a new, if brief, phase of history in the Near East. The age of fragmentation that took hold after the fall of the Ur III dynasty had been, somewhat paradoxically, stable in its instability. The various polities making up the political system of the Near East had fought. Conquest states had risen thanks to the talent of a charismatic and successful leader, and then those conquest states had fallen at the leader's death. Things then went back to normal, back to the state of endless competition, war, and diplomatic backstabbing that formed the basis of political life throughout the region. Even the players in that never-ending game mostly stayed the same. The cities where rulers built their palaces and from which they embarked on their campaigns were ancient places that outlived any one ruler or dynasty. They might be reconfigured into different territorial units, but the basic building blocks were remarkably stable. All of that seemed to shift, and did so quite rapidly, in the aftermath of Murshili's assault on Babylon. The stable system fell apart. On the whole, urbanization reached a low point after centuries of decline. Cities like Mari had been destroyed a century before, Nippur was abandoned. A whole series of new states, built on much different foundations of power and authority than their ancient predecessors, rose in their place. For around a century, from roughly 1590 BC to 1500 BC, the whole series of relationships that had defined this region for centuries was in a deep state of flux. The Hittites, in this sense, were the harbingers of a new era. They ended the ancient kingdom of Yamhad in Syria and brought down Hammurabi's dynasty, but they were only the first of the new club of great powers that would fight over the region until the Bronze Age collapse. Anatolia was only the furthest west of the zones of the Near East that saw the creation of new territorial states. There were at least four other zones, stretching from Elam in western Iran to the Mediterranean. They all seem to have had their roots to some extent in this quote-unquote Dark Age. The first of these new territorial states took hold in Mesopotamia. Somewhere between 25 and 75 years after the Hittite attack, this lack of specificity tells us a lot about the darkness of this Dark Age, a new dynasty conquered Babylon. They were Kassites, members of a somewhat enigmatic, semi-nomadic group that probably had its roots in the Zagros Mountains of western Iran. If a later king list is to be believed, the Kassites had had kings for a long time, only the 8th or the 9th of them was their first ruler of Babylon. Their language is unclassified, probably in isolate with no known relatives, but Babylon's new Kassite rulers soon mostly assimilated to their new home. They adopted everything from the religious to scribal practices that had been in place for centuries. Around 1475 BC, maybe 75 or 100 years after taking Babylon, the Kassites extended their rule into southern Mesopotamia as well as the central parts they already controlled. But the Kassite state functioned differently than its predecessors, like Hammurabi's conquered dominions. Where those conquest states had been an amalgam of city-states, each retaining their old organization and ways of doing things, the Kassite polity was a genuine territorial state. They had a name for their territory that went beyond the cities. Matkarduniash, land of the key of the god Duniash. They imposed uniform administrative divisions and governors, with administrators appointed by the king. Royal land grants were scattered through the countryside, which could be taken back and then re-granted in return for service. Over the course of four centuries of Kassite rule, the old city-state boundaries were largely replaced by the Kassite territorial divisions and administrative labels. The ultimate break with the old system came when one Kassite king built a brand new capital for himself, a place called Dur-Kurigalzu, near modern Baghdad. This was a genuine royal center. It was packed full of palaces and ziggurats, some of which still stand today. In a land that had traditionally been made up of ancient cities, building a brand new one fully decoupled the Kassites' rule from the prior way of doing things. In fact, this was the period when the idea of Babylonia, the term that would define this whole region for a thousand years or more, actually came into being. Babylonia spoke to a genuine regional identity, rather than one tied to a specific people or city. And Babylonian culture, in the sense of its literary and scribal traditions, was influential far beyond the heartland, as far as the Hittite court in Hattusha. As active as they were as administrators and cultural patrons, the Kassite rulers of Babylon did their best to stay on the sidelines of the great power competition of the later Bronze Age. They interacted mostly with their neighbors to the north, the famous Assyrians, who became a force only in the 14th century BC. Prior to that, the city of Assur and its people had been under the domination of another of the new polities rising from the ashes of the Dark Age, Mitanni. Mitanni is a confusing thing. It's not an ethnic name, but rather the name of a state that existed from at least 1500 BC to the late 14th century BC. This was a powerful state. Mitanni fought the Hittites and even the resurgent New Kingdom of Egypt before finally falling to the Hittites and the rising power of Assyria by around 1300 BC. In some contexts, though, Mitanni was instead called Hanigalbat, or the land of the Hurrians, who were assumed to be the inhabitants of the state. Hurrian is very clearly an ethnic label. It's one that already had a long history in this region well before the emergence of this particular state. Because of the confusion of the written sources from that Dark Age and the lack of them from Mitanni territory in the preceding decades, we can't even be sure precisely when this kingdom came into being. It might have been a powerful adversary around 1600 BC to those early Hittite kings, Hattusili and Murshili, or it might not have existed at all until a century later, around 1500 BC. The most likely explanation of the limited and confusing evidence sees a truly powerful Mitanni emerging around 1500 BC, with the caveat that it might already have existed on a smaller scale at the time of Hattusili a century before. What's certain is that there were already Hurrians, remember that ethnic label, and that the Hurrians had kingdoms that were both worth fighting and worth conquering in northern Syria and eastern Anatolia even before the first Hittite kings got expansive ambitions to their south and west. The Hurrians themselves are a bit of a mystery. They appeared in northern Syria and northern Mesopotamia around the time of Sargon of Akkad. They were presumably migrants from further to the north, but their ultimate origin is unknown. Their language belongs to its own family. It's unrelated to any other in the known record. It's not Semitic, it's not Indo-European, and the only other definite member of that family is Urartian, the language of the later Iron Age kingdom of Urartu. Kassite, which we talked about earlier, may have belonged to the family, but it's too poorly attested to say for sure. If I had to guess, I'd say that Hurrian was probably one of the languages spoken by people belonging to the Kura-Araxes, or Transcaucasian cultural tradition. This archaeological culture spread from north of the Caucasus Mountains all the way into eastern Anatolia, Syria, northern Mesopotamia, and part of the Iranian plateau between about 3400 and 2200 BC. We simply don't know, but it's clear that there were Hurrian speakers in this region, that they were perfectly willing and able to fight their neighbors, and that around 1500 BC, these petty Hurrian kingdoms coalesced into a much larger and more powerful unit called Mitanni. It gets even more confusing, though. That's because in addition to the Hurrian language, which was used in all official capacities, we see another set of names among the Mitanni ruling elite. These names were of Indo-European derivation, not Hurrian. More specifically, they were Indo-Aryan names, names that would have been perfectly at home in the extremely early Sanskrit texts of the Rig Veda, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away. In fact, these Indo-Aryan names, the few Indo-Aryan borrowings into Hurrian, and even the names of the Vedic deities that appear in the Rig Veda, are attested earlier in Mitanni than in South Asia itself. These Indo-Aryan naming practices among Mitanni royalty persist to the very end of Mitanni's existence, so it's not like this was some brief thing. To some extent, it has to be essential to understanding what Mitanni was, who its people and rulers were, and why they mattered in the broader scheme of Eurasian history. I'll give you the strongest and the weakest versions of how to interpret this, both of which have adherence among the scholars currently working on Mitanni. The strongest interpretation of this evidence would be that an Indo-Aryan-speaking elite group, made up of horseback warriors or more likely chariot riders, originally from somewhere between present-day Turkmenistan and Afghanistan, migrated to the west through the Iranian plateau. There, maybe somewhere in western Iran or today's Kurdistan, this group of Indo-Aryan migrants took over a Hurrian-speaking tribe or petty kingdom. From that base, this elite extended its rule further to the west, eventually absorbing all the small Hurrian polities in northern Syria and eastern Anatolia into the kingdom we call Mitanni. They stopped using their Indo-Aryan language, but they retained their distinctive names, their gods, and perhaps a specialization in chariot warfare. The term for charioteers in Hurrian is Mariani, which seems to be derived from the Indo-Aryan word Maria, young man. Now, the weak version, by contrast, goes like this. At some unknowable point in the centuries prior to the establishment of Mitanni, a group that later became Mitanni's ruling dynasty spoke Indo-Aryan. They retained the names and a couple of specific religious practices, probably to set themselves apart from their subjects. A very few Indo-Aryan words were borrowed into Hurrian. Now, according to this line of reasoning, there's no reason to think that this dynasty built the Mitanni state or that they were specialists in chariot warfare. We have no real idea which of these is closer to the truth. I lean toward the stronger version because I think it makes good sense, but that's just me. What's clear about these early Mitanni kings, as with the first Hittite rulers we talked about a bit earlier, is that they were war leaders who came to power in a period of extensive and damaging warfare. The petty Hurrian polities we see fighting against the Hittites weren't necessarily kingdoms. Some of them may have been groups of mercenary Hurrians led by a chieftain of some kind, and we know that there were similar groups of mercenaries, Hurrian and otherwise, operating throughout northern Mesopotamia throughout this period. One of the titles that the Mitanni kings adopted was Lugal Erenmesh Huri, King of the Hurrian Troops. Their rise must have been connected with the leadership of these groups of soldiers, maybe one group of military professionals forming a mutually beneficial relationship with another. There's no reason we have to think of kingship as being an especially elevated thing at first, just an exalted warrior among warriors, and then only later legitimizing the line of future Mitanni kings through their special foreign names and gods and so on. When we first properly see them, in the 16th century BC, we see kings of Mitanni as conquerors, exploiting the destruction wrought by Hattusili and Murshili in Syria to expand outward and claim disputed territory as their own. These were warrior kings confronting other warrior kings from the shaky platform of a horse-drawn chariot. We need to take a moment to talk about chariots. A chariot is not simply a wheeled vehicle, examples of which, pulled by oxen, onagers, or what have you, had been present in the Near East for a couple of millennia by the time the Mitanni kingdom came into existence. A chariot, by contrast, was a specific thing. It had only two wheels, which were spoked rather than solid. It was pulled by a horse with a bit in its mouth, and its driver stood to hold the reins and steer the horse and vehicle. The driver focused on the task of driving, while a second man, usually a high-status warrior, focused on doing the job of killing the enemy. A chariot provided an expert warrior with an exceptionally fast-moving platform from which he could pelt his adversaries with thrown spears or arrows, chase them down, and slay them. Imagine you're some poor guy with a spear and a shield, and you see 1,000 pounds of horse, man, and chariot bearing down on you at 30 miles an hour, 50 kilometers an hour. It would have been absolutely terrifying. The general consensus is that chariots were invented on the Eurasian steppe, perhaps by the Sintashta culture of today's northern Kazakhstan and southern Russia, east of the Ural Mountains, sometime just before 2000 BC. But from there, they quickly spread south into Central Asia, associated with the expansive Andronovo culture, and then far beyond. The Andronovo culture is usually associated with the spread of Proto-Indo-Iranian, the language ancestral to both Sanskrit and its descendants, and the many Iranian languages. By 1200 BC, chariots were present at both ends of Eurasia, everywhere from the fringes of the North Atlantic to China and pretty much everywhere in between. There's no reason to think that it had to have been the Indo-Aryans of the Mitanni elite who introduced chariots to the Near East. Remember the density of trade stretching east, all the way to the Andronovo homeland in the centuries prior to their appearance. The first signs of chariots in the Near East show up quite soon after that, by around 1750 BC, though they weren't used very much. The movement of the Indo-Aryans into that part of the Near East among the Mitanni, so far from their brethren in South Asia, was a feature rather than a bug. Whatever their ultimate origin, chariots were simply part of a world of intense military competition, mercenaries moving from one job to the next, and the transfer of technologies and ideas. The Hittites became expert chariot warriors, as did the Egyptians and the Mycenaean Greeks, among many others, not just Mitanni. But there's no doubt that Mitanni was home to extremely skilled charioteers, and that this skill was a major part of the kingdom's rise to power. What seems to have changed was the scale. Rather than forming a small and not especially important part of a Near Eastern army consisting mostly of infantry, chariots took on a drastically increased role, with all the cascading downward effects on society that implies. This was a dangerous world, and in it, specialist warriors, like the Hittites and Mitanni, thrived.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
The first stirrings of this new world of great power competition, complete with armies chock full of specialist charioteers, came over the course of that century-long Dark Age. In fact, rather than seeing this period as a Dark Age, the scholar Norman Yaffe has dubbed it an Age of Opportunity. For the founders of Mitanni, it certainly was. If we go back just a bit further, that was true for the Hittites as well. And it was absolutely the case for a resurgent power from the south, Egypt's new kingdom. During the second intermediate period, Egypt had fragmented into competing states, with kings ruling from both Thebes in Upper Egypt and from Avaris in the Nile Delta. The latter group of rulers were known as Hyksos, who had migrated to Lower Egypt from the Near East, probably the northern Levant. Rather than being foreign invaders, however, the Hyksos functioned more or less as standard Egyptian rulers, with the same kinds of names, religious practices, and political culture. If not for their enemies' eventual victory, we might see them as no less Egyptian than the kings of Thebes. But it was the kings of Thebes who did emerge victorious, and it was they who wrote the history, which means that the Hyksos were tarred with the brush of invading foreignness, no matter what modern scholarship and research has to say on the topic. If you'd like to know more about the Hyksos, check out the wonderful interview I did with the scholar Anna Latifa Murad from November 2021. We'll talk a lot more specifically about the New Kingdom in a later episode, but for now, what's essential to note is that the kings of Egypt's 18th dynasty had expansive ambitions. Once they'd unified Egypt, they set their sights on the surrounding lands. Ahmose, the dynasty's founder, invaded Nubia to the south, but scattered evidence also suggests that he campaigned in the Levant, perhaps against people who had been allied with his Hyksos enemies. If this was the case, we're talking more about a punitive expedition than an imperial project, because there's nothing to suggest an extended Egyptian presence there. Ahmose's successor, Amenhotep I, seems to have restricted himself to Nubia. But the next pharaoh, the famous Thutmose I, went far beyond his predecessors, inaugurating that new age of great power competition. Sometime around 1490 BC, Thutmose launched a campaign that took Egyptian armies through Palestine and Syria as far as the Euphrates River, where he erected what amounted to a mission accomplished banner in the form of a victory stela. Unlike Ahmose, however, Thutmose intended for Egypt to exercise considerable influence on the Levant and beyond. After the fall of the kingdom of Yamhad, centered on the city of Aleppo, to the Hittite king Murshili a century before, Syria had experienced something of a power vacuum. It was a patchwork of city-states and tiny petty kingdoms, much as the rest of the Near East had been for a very long time, without a regional overlord to whom those small states owed allegiance. Following Murshili's campaigns, the Hittites had attempted to retain their influence in this region to the south of their heartland. But after some initial success, the land of Hatti devolved again into internal bloodletting. Murshili's brother-in-law, a man named Hantili, assassinated him and took the throne. A later Hittite text stated that this act caused a divine campaign of vengeance against the kingdom. Hurrians ravaged Hittite territory, the queen and two of the king's sons died, and Hantili's remaining son and grandson were murdered in turn. The perpetrator of this round of killings was himself assassinated by his own son, and the cycle of violence went on in this fashion for several decades. With the Hittites sidelined and busy elsewhere, we first hear of Mitanni, exercising influence in the fragmented lands of Syria. This was presumably the role that Thutmose wanted to occupy when he brought his army north, apparently without resistance. In fact, this is the context in which we first hear of Mitanni from outsiders. The Egyptian state official Amenemhet's grave inscription in the city of Thebes mentions the land of Mitanni in the course of Thutmose's Syrian campaign. We don't know much more than that, aside from the fact that Mitanni was already something like the regional hegemon in Syria, and Thutmose wanted that for himself. But Thutmose didn't follow up on his first campaign, despite his mission accomplished stela and his apparently serious intentions. And Egyptian power only really extended into southern Palestine during the rule of his successor Hatshepsut. With Egypt otherwise occupied, Mitanni expanded westward into Syria in earnest. This was overlordship, local rulers making treaties under the authority of the Mitanni king, Paratarna, with the threat of military force. But Mitanni's ambitions went beyond a claim to rule. Evidence suggests Mitanni involvement even in small-scale legal cases involving local citizenship and property, reallocating towns from one subject kingdom to another, hefty tribute demands, and military support in times of war. Mitanni's increasing involvement in Syria brought them to the doorstep of the land of Hatti. Given the long history of warfare between Hurrians and Hittites, Mitanni certainly would have kept going west and north into Anatolia if they could. Before that happened, however, a new player entered the game, the Egyptian ruler Thutmose III. Like his grandfather, Thutmose I, Thutmose III had grand ambitions in Syria. Unlike his grandfather, Thutmose III intended to stick around. He crushed a coalition of Canaanites, inhabitants of the southern Levant, who were acting with the backing of Mitanni. According to Egyptian sources, they were planning an invasion of Egypt, though even if this was true, it was probably a preemptive strike aimed at dissuading Thutmose III's plans for Syria. The resulting Battle of Megiddo, Armageddon, is one of the first, if not the first, battles in history for which we have a detailed description, including precise numbers of the dead, the types and amounts of plunder taken, and the enemies faced. 340 prisoners in one clash, 83 dead, 924 chariots seized, 31 captured chieftains, and so on. We even know the date, May 9th, 1457 BC. His crushing victory at the Battle of Megiddo marked the beginning of Thutmose III's long process of campaigning in the Levant and Syria. He would soon go much further, and in doing so, he would set the terms of a great power competition that would last for more than two centuries. Thutmose returned in subsequent years to collect tribute from his new territories, but despite their vassals' defeat at Megiddo, Mitanni wasn't ready to give up their interests in Syria. New Egyptian campaigns led by the king conquered a whole series of cities along the Orontes River in Syria, and Thutmose even crossed the Euphrates to launch a lightning-quick and devastating invasion of the Mitanni heartland itself. On his return, Thutmose put up his own mission-accomplished stela along the Euphrates, right next to that of his grandfather. But within 2 years of this great victory, the king of Mitanni had assembled a new army and returned. He fought a major set-piece battle with the Egyptians near Aleppo. The Egyptians, as always, claimed victory, but the tiny number of prisoners and the minuscule plunder taken in the battle suggest that it was at best a draw, if not an outright defeat. Mitanni was far from done, and in fact, its period of greatest influence and power still lay in the future. Egyptian expeditions continued year after year, even late into Thutmose III's long reign. His son and heir, Amenophis II, campaigned in Syria soon after his appointment as co-ruler with his father. One record tells us of how he slew seven chieftains with his mace and hanged six others from the walls of Thebes, all standard fare for an Egyptian ruler on the rise. What's clear, even amid the confusion of incomplete records, is the fact that this was an imperial competition between Egypt and Mitanni. The Egyptians weren't exacting tokens of surrender and then heading home, they came back year after year. They demanded submission to the pharaoh on specifically Egyptian terms, precisely as the Egyptian subjects of the king were expected to submit. These northern subjects were expected to provide inwe, a vague Egyptian term referring to the involuntary tribute owed to the pharaoh by his inferiors. In that sense, we can see the parallels with Mitanni's involvement in legal cases and demands for tribute. The rivalry between Egypt and Mitanni continued, drawing still more participants into this imperial game. The city of Assur, threatened by Mitanni expansion but soon to surpass it, sent gifts to Thutmose on at least two occasions. So did Babylon, ruled by the Kassites. None were happier than the Hittites to see Mitanni occupied, and Thutmose III's mini-campaigns may have been something like a stay of execution for a kingdom racked by bloody succession disputes. Egyptian records speak of a steady stream of gifts from Great Khate, obviously the land of Hatti, that accompanied each of Thutmose's major Syrian campaigns. Silver, gems, and wood in the king's 24th year, silver, gold, and wood in year 35, silver vessels, lapis lazuli, ore, and wood in year 42. This imperial competition over Syria was just getting started. The Hittites were beginning to emerge from their internal conflicts. The assassination of their king, Muwatalli, marked the end of this old kingdom phase around 1400 BC, and his successor, Tudhaliya I, was the beginning of its expansive new kingdom. Saushtatar, Mitanni's greatest king, conquered previously independent Assur and brought northern Syria under firm and direct Mitanni control. Soon, the Hittites would join Mitanni and Egypt in the struggle for control over Syria. And that conquered city, Assur, would eventually throw off the Mitanni yoke and found an immensely powerful empire of its own, the Middle Assyrian Empire. These were the Bronze Age empires, Hittite, Kassite, Mitanni, Egypt, and eventually Assyrian. For all that they still had vassal kings underneath them and extended their influence over fractious city-states in Syria and Palestine, their conception of power was much different than that of their Mesopotamian predecessors. These were territorial states with sophisticated systems of governance that came into existence in competition with one another. No one conqueror ruled over his adversaries as Hammurabi, the Ur III kings, or Naram-Sin of Akkad had done before them. This was a political game of equals contested on an enormous geographic scale from Babylon to central Anatolia to Egypt. It's what political scientists might call pure polity competition of a type that was genuinely new. What we have to understand is that these didn't emerge in isolation from one another. They were in contact through letters, emissaries, and treaties. They acted and responded to one another's actions. Military technologies and mercenaries passed from one to the next and back again. It's surely not a coincidence that all of these new states came into existence at the same time. We're talking about a new system, not just the emergence of a conquest state or a charismatic ruler. And all of this laid the groundwork for the remarkable world of the late Bronze Age. Until, that was, it all came crashing down. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to head a long way to the east, to the opposite end of Eurasia. In China, the transition from the Neolithic to the Bronze Age involved much different processes of transformation and state formation, processes that culminated in the emergence of China's first historical dynasty, the Shang.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now in hard copy, ebook, or on audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.